This is Audible.
Soundings Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of A Lawless Place, written by David Donaghy, read by Peter Noble. The moral right of the author has been asserted. This performance is owned by Soundings Whitley Bay, NE26, 2JT. Chapter 1. It was the sound of loud snoring that woke Betsy Langridge. The next thing to register was a splitting headache, soon followed by the realization she had no memory of how she'd got to her bedroom. Indeed, no recall at all of the night before. After several seconds of confusion, Betsy was also wondering why she was fully clothed, and that included her outdoor shoes. Having hauled herself upright, she staggered round to the vacant side of the bed to find there a total stranger. A young fellow with corn-coloured hair, crumpled in a sort of fetal position, clutching an empty brandy bottle and snoring steadily. There was a pool of bile close to his mouth, the stench of which had her swoon, the supports of the four-poster enabling her to endure the wave of nausea without falling. Betsy tried to make sense of what she was seeing, coming slowly to the conclusion there was none. Looking towards the bedroom door, it seemed not to be fixed. Indeed, the whole room, the walls, the fireplace, and the floor appeared to be moving in and out of focus, which made the move towards it otherworldly. Each step was an effort, accompanied by a feeling that at any moment her legs could give way. Opening the door revealed a house in darkness as well as silence. The light from a near full moon was coming through the large landing window, throwing forward a shaft strong enough to bathe everything in a silvery glow. Tempted to go back into the room to ring the bell by the fireplace and summon a servant, she reasoned it cruel to drag them from their beds. Betsy was also worried about stability, which made the newel post at the head of the stairs a better bet for an outstretched hand. What followed was a slow and cautious downward progress, one step at a time, both hands on the banister, until she made the ground floor. The same shaft of moonlight bounced off the highly polished boards, providing enough of a gleam to make further progress possible. Not that she could move on immediately. Betsy had to stop and gather herself, eyes tight shut, for given her exertions, she felt close to a faint. Only after several deep breaths could she raise her head, opening them to look around. Familiarity identified the outlines of the various items of furnishing in the spacious hallway. The twin settles, and in the center of the circular table, a great silver and light-reflecting bowl, which prompted a memory. At the social gathering she had organized weeks before, it had served as a receptacle for a popular rum punch, too much so for some of the guests. There had been gaiety, laughter, with melancholy Cottington Court and its grounds turned into a place of pleasure, brought on by numerous guests and games, a gathering of old friends and acquaintances, followed by a splendid dinner in a specially erected marquee to round off a wonderful day. How long ago that seemed. Like another world. It was slow to dawn on Betsy, as more slivers of memory intruded. She should not be here in this house, a place she'd been determined to flee. Or was that a dream? Was Edward Brazier, who had promised to come and take her to freedom and much more besides, an illusion? A faint strip of light coming from her brother's study, leaking out from under the door, caught her eye. It needed the support of both her hands on the wainscot to make progress towards it. And once outside, turning the handle also required effort. The catch released, She fell forward, which threw the door open, leaving her hanging onto the brass knob as her knees nearly gave way. A multi-branch candlestick sat on Henry's desk, all the wax stems guttering and not far off vanishing. He was asleep in a chair before the fireplace, his long, spindly legs stretched out, crossed at the feet, shoes almost in the grate, hands folded corpse-like on his chest. There was little but ash now, with the odd faint hint of red, where the last of the embers retained some heat. Hauling herself upright, Betsy made the distance between the door and Henry's huge desk to stand, hands pressed down, wondering at the disorder. Highly unusual for a man so fussy about everything being orderly. There were two empty champagne bottles, used glasses, and, once she turned her head, in another chair, the wild pepper-and-salt hair of the Reverend Joshua Moyle. He lay crowned to one side with tongue lolling out, also sound asleep.
Elizabeth?
Reacting too speedily to what was an urgent whisper nearly unbalanced her. One hand clutching the edge of the desk was required to stop her from sinking to her knees. Her Aunt Sarah stood in the doorway, looking anxious and making frantic gestures for both silence and that she should come away. Slow-witted, Betsy failed to respond, so her aunt closed the space between them, took her arm and led her back out into the hallway, softly pulling the door shut behind her.
"What is happening?"
"I scarce know where I am."
"My poor dear,"
was all Sarah Lovell could say in response, this imparted in a voice full of misery.
"I never realized Henry could be so wicked."
"Why? What has he done?"
"Best sit, Elizabeth," was the reply, as Betsy was eased on to one of the hallway settles.
The scream, which rent the air a few minutes later, was enough to wake the dead, if not those too drunk to hear it. It stirred Henry Tulkington, who shuddered slightly at the unpleasant feeling of being chilled. For a moment, he too was left to wonder where he was and why. What did register was the fur on his tongue, as well as the sour taste of stale wine on his breath. Rising, his legs stiff from discomfort until fully erect, he laid his hands on the mantel to stare into the embers as the events of the last few hours came back to him, bringing forth a feeling of satisfaction. The crash of his door being thrown open, so violently it hit the wall, had him spin round. There stood his younger sister, glaring at him, her hands stretched out to hold herself steady on the frame. Even with a slightly woolly head, and knowing he was in for a tongue-lashing, Henry forced himself to smile.
"Elizabeth, my dear."
"You utter swine!"
"What a lack of gratitude. I must profess myself shocked."
"I will not let this stand."
"Really? I don't see how you can do anything to alter it."
"What did you put in that champagne?"
Henry picked up one of the bottles to examine it, as though it was an article unknown to him.
"The means to make you compliant, which I see as being in the service of your best interests as well as my own."
A snuffling sound had Henry look towards Moyle, whose head had slipped off the back of the chair to leave him, hand outstretched towards the floor, suspended over the padded arm.
"And here was the means to make it so."
"No, never!"
Henry moved a couple of feet towards the desk, to look down at a large open ledger, onto which he laid and drew a finger, followed by a quick glance at the wall clock, When he spoke, he did so in a voice full of faux wonder.
"Dated yesterday, Elizabeth. Mr. Harry Spafford, groom, was joined in holy matrimony to Mrs. Elizabeth Langridge, widow. Service conducted by the Reverend Dr. Joshua Moyle, vicar of the parish of Cottington. Witnessed by myself and your Aunt Sarah."
The tone changed to icy disdain as he looked at her shaking head and heard her muttered denials.
"You sought to defy me, Elizabeth, and that was bad enough. Yet worse was being interrogated on matters which were none of your concern. I must have failed to satisfy you, given you sank to the point of acting the spy."
Her head-shaking became more pronounced, accompanied by a tearful whimper. "Do you think me a fool? Did I not find you in this very room when you thought I was absent? What were you seeking in here? Something damaging to pass on to your naval captain?" The finger jabbed the ledger. "You put his interests before that of your own family. This is payment for your duplicity." The tone lightened again, becoming almost jocose.
"You will not be aware of it, but Brazier came for you, I suspect by arrangement. And he was not alone. Was it to help you elope? To run away and bring disgrace upon the family? He and his band of ruffians were stood outside yonder window, just after your nuptials. I confess I was tempted to ask him in so he could act as an extra witness, but I doubt he would have seen the delicious irony."
"He will kill you."
"No, sister," was a malevolent hiss, "unless he wants to swing in Newgate. Even now I could have him arrested, given that in front of a crowd of witnesses he aimed a pistol at my head. I shall pen a note to your admirer, and advise him, since his purpose in coming to deal is no longer capable of being realized, it would be best for all if he departed and went back to whichever rock he crawled from under."
"Well, well," was all he said, as Betsy fainted away, to crumple in the doorway. A bell was rung to rouse out the servants, and once they had responded, Henry Tulkington gave them their instructions.
"Take Mrs. Spafford to her bedroom."
Faced with a blank look at the use of the name, he shouted, which was past unusual for a man ever in tight control of his emotions, "That is her name now, and by damn I hope she has good cause to regret it." It had taken time and 8 strong arms to get Edward Brazier back to Deal, which came with many an admonishment telling him it would be impossible, whatever he thought, to bring on immediate redress. The odds they had faced, some 2 dozen of Tulkington's hard and armed bargains, were too great to contest with. Even if they'd shot a couple, and it had been considered, it would have ended in a beating, and possibly much worse. All 5 had got away from Cottington Court, exiting through the same hidden postern gate by which, with such high hopes, they had entered an hour before. They took with them, for security, the unsteady figure of one John Hawker, he being Henry Tulkington's right-hand man, and a nasty bastard to boot. Belting him had provided one of the few bright spots of an otherwise disastrous night. The blow had been delivered by Tom Dutchy Holland, who was more than a match in size for most men and could land a punch enough to fell an ox. When in service aboard the frigate HMS Diomede, he had served as coxswain to Edward Brazier. It was he who'd taken the lead in getting his one-time captain away. Not that he could have succeeded on his own, It had required the combined efforts of all of his erstwhile shipmates, both physical and verbal, to move him. Peddler Palmer had prized Brazier's pistol from him, lest, given his mood of uncontrolled fury, he shot Hawker out of hand. Every time he turned to go back and sort out that bastard Tulkington, Dutchy had required the help of Peddler, as well as Cocky Logan, and Brazier's servant, Joe Lascelles, to both restrain him and keep the head of his horse pointed in the right direction. It was a slow ride back to Deal, made so by both the gloom and their prisoner. He was hauled along on foot, to be dragged along the ground when he fell. Hawker had been dumped as soon as they felt they were far enough from Cottington to be secure, thrown into a muddy ditch, and left to make his own way back, no mercy being shown to a man devoid of that quality in his own disreputable life. It was a town long asleep to which they returned, with barely a lantern still burning in a window. Even the numerous places of entertainment were closed, though a few of their customers were still about, and ambulant, if barely so. Brazier was pushed through the door of his rented home as Peddler took the reins of the horses, leading them towards the nearby navy yard, where they would be stabled for the remainder of the night.
"Get a fire going, Joe," Dutchy asked. "Don't see us getting much sleep with the captain in such a state."
Cocky Logan was quick to add his opinion, delivered in his strong Scots brogue.
"If we did, one of us would have to lay against the front door. You ken what the Turk's like when his dander's up."
The use of Brazier's sobriquet got sage nods from the others. Given to him as a fresh-faced midshipman many years previously, it had stuck. It went with his saturnine looks as well as his temperament, that of a fighting sailor ever eager for action, one man or boy who would bear no condescension from anyone. Right now he was sat in the parlour, staring at an empty inglenook, lost in his own thoughts. All of them were circled around ways to reverse what had occurred, for he had no doubt the claimed marriage of Betsy Langridge to this Spafford creature was illegal. Even as he ruminated on this, he could not bring himself to believe Henry Tulkington had gone so far to prevent him marrying his sister. He'd only known of the man for a number of weeks, but to say they'd not hit it off on first meeting was an understatement. At first, Brazier could not pin down a reason. Tulkington, for no discernible motive, seemed dead set against his widowed sister remarrying anyone, and that extended especially to him. He'd sought deflection by implying Brazier was a fortune hunter, given that Betsy, over 2 years widowed, was in possession of several highly profitable sugar plantations. That was easy to prove as nonsense. A successful post-captain in King George's Navy, Edward Brazier was prosperous in his own right. In addition to his rank and pay, he had, in the Caribbean, taken a Spanish vessel carrying a cargo of silver. The Spaniard having been captured, and in French possession for over 2 days, it could legitimately be claimed as a prize when the French privateer was sunk. Madrid had complained vigorously, only to be ignored by Whitehall. Both ship and cargo had been bought in through the prize court, and that included head and gun money for the crew and the armaments, the proceeds to be distributed to the crew of HMS Diomede. As the ship's captain, he'd been in receipt of an eighth of the money, with a further tranche of the same size coming to him as the senior officer on a station which, due to an untimely death, lacked a commanding admiral. The truth had finally emerged when he'd been told of Tulkington's true colours, which were dark and menacing. Far from merely being a highly successful man of business, he had control of smuggling on the East Kent coast near to an industry, as well as a firm grip on the trade in the town of Deal, where he was feared and admired in equal measure. The prospect of an upright naval officer as a brother-in-law seriously alarmed him. This was enough to take an apparent disinclination to approve of his intentions onto a violent reaction. The severe beating to which Brazier had been subjected, mystifying at the time, and within days of his arrival in Deal, stemmed from that sort. Unaware of the cause at that point and given a misleading name to chew on, had caused Brazier to send for some old shipmates to guard against repetition. Joe Lascelles apart, the trio of Dutchy, Pedler, and Cocky were all handy in a fight. They'd been the reliable men of his barge crew, always by his side when action was called for. Often they formed a boarding party, seeking to get a foothold on an opposed deck with never a hesitation at the prospect of hurt. With them around, he felt his back was safe from the still mysterious threat. When the truth about Tulkington emerged, he was doubly grateful for their presence. "I fetched a bottle of brandy, Your Honour. Thought you might need it." Brazier glanced up at Dutchy. A man who could look down on him stood upright. The bottle in his hand appeared tiny, the crystal goblet even more so. Joe Lascelles slipped by, flashing one of those smiles that always lit up his dark-skinned face, his arms laden with kindling with which to get going the fire. "What I need right now, Dutchy, is the whole of the crew of Diomede armed and ready for a cutting out."
"Wouldn't serve, Your Honour."
"It would serve to satisfy me." Holland gave no reply. He knew himself to be right, just as he knew Brazier would see the sense when his mind cleared. This was not like being at sea in wartime, contesting control of the oceans with the French and Spaniards, or dealing with ex-colonists running contraband into the Sugar Islands from America. It was on land, at a time of peace, and there was the law to contend with.
"I can't let it go."
"Didn't reckon you could."
"Did you see her, Dutchy?"
"Not as plain as you, Captain."
Brazier was back at the large sash window of Henry Tulkington's study. With John Hawker's men threatening his back and the well-lit room before him, Betsy's brother had come to and opened the window. He stood grinning as he looked down the barrel of Brazier's pistol, no doubt reckoning the man his sister had planned to run away with would not shoot. He had no idea how close he had come to being mistaken.
"Betsy was looking straight at me, Dutchy, but with no recognition in her eyes. It was as if I was not there. The priest was drunk, and so was what I assumed to be the one named Harry Spafford."
Brazier recalled Betsy's aunt as well, her eyes red with weeping while clutching a handkerchief, which looked as if it had been much employed. Sarah Lovell had never given any indication of liking him, obvious from the first time he'd come across her in Jamaica. As Betsy's chaperone, sent out by her nephew after her being widowed, it had been her task to ward off the attentions of eager suitors, and given her niece's evident beauty, added to her known affluence, they had been many. But there had been real sadness when their eyes met. Surely she would not have just stood by and let this happen.
"Your lady's likely a fighter, Captain, and will sort matters out without you go seeking blood. Happen things'll look better once you've had a chance to pass a word with her."
"I hope you're right, Dutchy. And since you brought that brandy, you'd best fetch another 4 goblets. I have no desire this night to drink alone."
Chapter 2 John Hawker waited till the slow clip-clop of the hooves fell away to silence before he lifted himself up, not without pain, to clamber back onto the rutted dirt road. If he was murderously furious, Hawker also knew nothing could be done about it at this time. He needed to get back home to clean himself up, as well as to examine the scrapes and scratches with which he reckoned himself to be covered. He had spent as much time being dragged as he had staggering on the end of a rope. His clothing was torn, both coat and breeches, in many places, which mattered little as long as he was not seen in such a state. A man who revelled in his fearsome reputation, this had him, as cloud cover obscured the moon, bless the darkness, even if it made progress difficult. Normally, night or day, John Hawker walked in dread of no man in these parts. Very much the reverse. People made way for him to pass, and if some made to ignore him, it was from fear of catching his eye. Progressing unsteadily, sometimes stumbling, both from his still muzzy condition and the uneven ground, he eventually put aside the curses and visions of revenge he would later rain down on Brazier, as well as the jack-tar bastards he led. Instead, he concentrated on Henry Tulkington, for it was clear this night, it could be imputed, he had let his employer down. It would have taken a man with the powers of a saint to foresee that two problems, the trespass of Dan Spafford's smuggling gang coinciding with the arrival of Brazier, would merge into one. But that might not count with a man who could be capricious. Any reckoning there would have to wait as well. But he could not avoid concern, for he had sensed recently the bond that held him and Tulkington together to the profit of both was not as secure as it needed to be. It had been a long, solitary walk back to Worth for Jaleel, Daisy Trotter, one in which he had tried and utterly failed to make head or tail of that which he had just witnessed. Everything was in a state of flux, yet such had been true of these last weeks, as Dan Spafford had sought a way to bring down Henry Tulkington, or at least secure a profitable hold on his own smuggling operations. In terms of size, it was the Tulkington whale versus the Spafford minnow. Now the country was at peace. Profits were cut so far to the bone that Dan was close to giving up the game altogether. His only alternative was to somehow even matters up between him and the man who controlled nearly all the running of contraband on this stretch of coast. The first attempt, contrived by Daisy, to trick their rival into a dubious alliance, had failed. But there had followed for a brief window a feeling of matters levelling up, this coming as they stole Tulkington's recently landed goods, carried out in a manner that denied him certainty the Spafford gang were the culprits. Thanks to Dan's useless son Harry, the deception had collapsed. He'd given chapter and verse of what his pa had been up to. Spafford Jr. was a whoremonger and drunk, as well as a constant disappointment to his overindulgent sire. He'd fallen into the hands of John Hawker with foreseeable results, for the boy was weak. Daisy, who'd known Harry since the day he was spawned, could well imagine how little of a threat to his person would have to be mooted to get from him a full admission of what he knew. "You should have left the little sod to rot, Dan," was not spoken silently, it being cried to the heavens, for there was real anger in the sentiment, "or let Hawker feed him to the pigs instead of seeking to bargain for him." Daisy became distraught when he thought on what might have happened to Dan, a man he had known, loved and served since they were both nippers sailing trading ships on the Baltic route. Dan had gone to treat with Tulkington for his boy, ostensibly going to the meeting alone. In truth, not trusting the bastard, he had arranged for his gang to sneak in to Cottington Court, available to free Harry by force if necessary. The ploy had been anticipated, and in a night of utter confusion, Spafford's men had been outwitted and were now prisoners. Daisy, who'd managed in the darkness and confusion to hide from everyone, his own mates included, was adrift in wondering how to right matters. If Dan was still alive, and that not a certainty, a way had to be found to get him free, which raised many insurmountable difficulties. He could see no way to achieve it, especially on his own. Once he made a cot in which sleep would come eventually, one name, overheard, kept coming to mind, to repeat itself endlessly in his brain until the sky lightened to herald the approach of a new day. There'd been a third lot in the chaotic brawl Daisy had witnessed, which had made what was bewildering enough even more confusing. He could clearly recall the name Henry Tulkington had used for what was clearly another adversary, a fellow who had aimed a pistol at Tulkington and looked set to pull the trigger. Who in creation was this Captain Brazier? Sarah Lovell found Henry alone and eating breakfast, informing her nephew of the comatose drunken figure lying beside his sister's bed, to suggest that at the very least the mess he had made be cleaned up. In doing so, she underlined for him the fact that he too had fallen asleep at a time when he should not have done so. His aunt also reminded him of a factor to which he had given insufficient attention in his haste to thwart his sister. What would be expected to happen after a normal marriage, which this was most assuredly not. Much as Elizabeth had enraged him and brought upon herself the present fate, he had no notion that being wedded to a slug like Harry Spafford should proceed to anything like consummation. What might emerge from that was too horrible to contemplate. Have the servants move Spafford to another room.
Henry.
Looking at Sarah Lovell, Henry would have had to be blind not to note her anxiety.
I acted as I did because Elizabeth gave me no choice.
There came to him a wheedling tone as he sought to cast himself as the victim in the affair. Not an unusual way for him to behave.
I tried to reason with her, but would she listen? No, as ever, she was headstrong and selfish.
I believe she became strongly attracted to Captain Brazier, even more so than she showed in Jamaica.
The response was cutting. Something I sent you to the West Indies to stop. Sarah Lovell wanted to reply that no one could overcome such feelings, but held her tongue. She depended on Henry for the very food she ate and the bed she slept in. Given what he'd just done to his own sister, there could be little doubt he would cast her out of this house if she failed to please him. And she was penniless. Her eyes dropped, to avoid being seen to be defiant when faced with a challenging look.
I do hope I can rely on you, Aunt Sarah.
Of course, nephew.
I will not have Elizabeth suffer any more than is necessary. You have my word upon it.
Given he'd dropped his head as he said this, to concentrate on his food, she was far from sure it was safe to believe him, but there was no room for a rebuttal. Best to change the subject.
The Reverend has gone, I take it?
Home, yes.
That was followed by a chortle. Henry Tulkington was not a man much given to laughter. Very much the reverse. But Moyle, so distant from what he should be when it came to both honesty, divinity, and behaviour, always seemed to amuse him.
No doubt to a thorough and well-deserved wigging from his good lady wife.
She was tempted to speak once more to say he would benefit from such a thing, both the consort and the berating. That, too, was suppressed, but she did manage a slight barb.
I will go and see to your fine addition to the household.
The sarcasm flew right over Henry's bowed head. Two grooms had to be fetched from the stables, men who would have no trouble in bodily lifting Spafford. Not true of the indoor servants. Her next command was to fetch hot water to Betsy's bedroom with cloths to clean up the vomit. Only then did she go to the room itself to stand by her niece, taking and holding her hand as her instructions were obeyed. Subjected to many a curious glance, all were studiously ignored. The servants would be full of inquisitiveness as to what had happened both the night before and what was being undertaken now. With the level of hullabaloo, at least some must have overheard things happening in the twilight hours. Let them wonder and gossip. They would hear nothing from her lips. Once the room was clear and cleaned, a fire laid and burning, she went to the door and closed it, turned the key in the lock, removed and pocketed it. Back at the bedside, she gazed at a sleeping Elizabeth, reprising the depressing events of the last few hours, before moving to take a chair by the fireplace, to wonder at what the future would hold. Henry lay back in a leather chair, the razor his manservant was wielding gently scraping the light growth off his face. Eyes on the ceiling, he sought to formulate a way to proceed, for what had occurred these last 48 hours, the coming together of a whole set of disparate problems, had left no time for contemplation of outcomes. Indeed, the possibilities had been too numerous. There was no feeling that he had overreacted. As the heir to his position, both legal and questionable, he had seen it as vital to protect his inheritance. In addition, he valued his standing both locally and in other parts of the country, the prospect of a sister neither beholden to him nor under his control, and one who, in her intended misalliance with Brazier, might bring everything crashing down, was too dangerous to contemplate. Not wishing to dwell on that, he turned his thinking to the one thing that was certain, an outcome that brought much satisfaction. He had smashed the Spafford gang, who'd been an irritant for years. He could, of course, have brought that on at any time of his own choosing, but sense dictated it could very likely not be done without public violence. In the smuggling game, it never served to attract attention, which open conflicts or too aggressive a way of behaving tended to produce. The revenue service, poorly paid and badly provided for, was inactive enough to suit the Tulkington purpose. To this was added the occasional sprat John Hawker threw their way, normally a group of souls operating off Deal Beach who had forewarned a man they trusted of their intentions. Start a war, with possible public bloodshed, and it would bring in the army, as it had 3 decades past with the Hawkhurst gang. Many of that crew had either been killed by the soldiers, or had been captured to swing for their crimes, and that was not a fate to contemplate. So, much as they had irritated him, and, in truth, their activities barely dented his own, Tulkington had let Spafford operate. But stealing his goods went beyond tolerance and good fortune, which he saw almost as his due, and had delivered them into his hands. Spafford Senior was chained in his cellar, the younger one upstairs, probably still snoring his head off. The other gang members had been sent off with Hawker's men, instructions being given to make for the Deal slaughterhouse cum tannery, where he reckoned they would rejoin Hawker himself, once that swine Brazier released him. Not that he was entirely clear of their baleful presence. The father presented more of a problem than the son, for he was a cussed individual, typical of the coast, rough of manner and speech, with a stubbornness that seemed to characterize the lower classes of East Kent. The original notion of absorbing Spafford into his own operations might appear a solution, but it was not necessarily a secure one. Henry Tulkington was careful to keep his activities clandestine, and his involvement in the actual act of smuggling at arm's length. Indeed, even having the men he employed come to Cottington had broken a rule. Everything locally went through Hawker. Only financing and the arrangements for disposal were overseen by him. Spafford, who knew too much and could not necessarily be relied on to hold his tongue, might jeopardize that. Still, in the presence of his worthless son, Henry held the same high card that had led to his capture. Threatened to harm the boy, and his father would do as he was told. Harry was easy to deal with. Given the slightest threat to his person rendered him a wreck. He reasoned that as long as he was provided with the means to buy drink and entertain whores, and with the prospect of a sound thrashing always in the background, young Spafford would give him little trouble. That accepted, other problems arose, like his lack of discretion, really a tongue too easily loosened. To have him carousing in Deal and at his usual haunts risked what had just happened at Cottington Court being talked about around the town. And that was anathema. He considered the possibility of sending both Spafford and his sister off to the West Indies to take charge of her plantations. They'd come to Elizabeth after the death of Stephen Langridge, and would now devolve to the control of Spafford as her new spouse. The prospect of him, in possession of the income from those properties while many months distant from any oversight, did not bear thinking about. He would either ruin them through mismanagement or drink away the income they generated. His face was being towelled when a footman entered with an unsealed and scribbled note, which simply said his presence would be appreciated, appended with the letters J.H. There was no need to mention a location, that was a commonplace. He would comply, but first he had to allow himself the pleasure of a gloat, which took him to the cellar, to face the cause of one half of his present concerns. He was about to ask Grady, his senior servant cum valet, and the man who had just shaved him for the key to the cellar, only to recall he had demanded the man surrender it the day before. If it was given up swiftly, it had been impossible not to notice it had been done with little grace, which reprised a thought often considered. Retainers had to be continually reminded of their place, especially long-serving ones, lest they get ideas above their station. Dan Spafford was sat on the floor, seemingly half asleep. The chain and padlock with which John Hawker had restrained him, set to keep him well away from any of the bottles in the racks that lined the walls. The sound of Tulkington's footsteps had him look up to see his nemesis moving towards him slowly and carefully, pulling bottle after bottle from the racks and examining the labels. "It's reckoned to be one of the best cellars in Kent, Spafford. Did you know that? You have slept, surrounded by wines of a quality to which you could never aspire or appreciate. Not that quality is a word anyone would apply to you." "The boy," Dan Spafford demanded, "is alive," was stated without a hint of feeling. Towering over his captive, Tulkington looked down into the square, red-skinned face, showing as it did evidence of poor stock, added to a life spent either at sea or on an exposed shoreline. The expression returned was not one of supplication. Spafford probably expected his fate to be terminal, yet he was not going to beg that it should be otherwise. The gaze was steady, taking in the tall, slim figure with the slightly hollow chest and the habitual, haughty expression.
"There's alive, and barely so.
Your progeny is, if you excuse what will be a sore morning head, in better health than you could imagine."
"Don't mock me, Tulkington."
"While it would give me great pleasure to do so, I am not. But I am wondering what to do about you."
"I expect your worst."
Henry put a finger and thumb to his chin as if in deep contemplation.
"That might be a solution."
"Not that your hand'll be employed, whatever you have in mind. That'll be left to Hawker. You see yourself as too much the gent to soil them, not that it's true. A man can be as much a shit in silk as in sackcloth.
That broke the studied Tulkington reserve. With a furious expression, he lashed out with a foot to kick Spafford's knee. When his victim declined to react with a squeal of justified pain, he repeated the blow, to then make a great effort to contain himself.
I will not let you rile me, Spafford, for you are unworthy of my anger.
The Spafford jaw was set tight when he replied. If he was determined not to show pain, it did not mean he felt none.
Unchain me, and I'll stand against you with any weapon you choose, pistol, sword, or knife.
What? Tulkington sneered, his manner of equanimity restored. Grant you the attributes of a gentleman?
Fists are more your station. I ask for fair, nothing more.
You may ask, but it is I who dispose. It may please you to learn I have yet to decide what to do with you, so you will have to rest where you are until I do. I might even feed you, to show that I am not the ogre you imagine.
The condemned man eats a hearty meal.
It will not, I assure you, be hearty. You warrant no more than bread and water.
Bastard,
was the Stafford response, as Henry Tulkington walked away and up the cellar steps. Halfway to the ground floor, it dawned on him. He could not ask a servant to take even bread and water to Spafford. Despite what had happened, it was a tenet that nothing of his illicit activities was allowed to infiltrate the walls of Cottington Court. So he would be required to undertake that duty himself, a thought that came near to being nauseating. It was a small leap, then, to the conclusion that the man would have to wait. In the hallway, the cellar locked behind him and about to call for his coach, he paused. Given the excitements of the last 12 hours, he felt a strong need for carnal gratification. The means of that, as well as the location, was not something to share with anyone, least of all a couple of gossipy coachmen.
Tell the grooms to get my horse ready.
20 minutes later, wrapped in a heavy coat, with a muffler to protect his neck and a hat pulled low over his head, Henry Tulkington emerged from his front door to find his horse saddled and waiting. Not an eye met his, which was as it should be. Likewise, no brow was raised at his attire, excessive for a mild day, in which Upton, the head groom, was stood, and happily so, in a sleeveless smock and a leather apron. His master, a man known to be ever careful of his well-being, was convinced every wind that blew or drop of rain that fell was designed to bring onto his being all manner of afflictions. When Betsy came back to wakefulness, it was to find a fire in the grate and her aunt dozing beside it. She lay still, gazing at the silken bed canopy, as the enormity of what had happened assailed her. That quickly shifted to remedies, which led to how to conjure up the means to secure an annulment. Yet even as pressing as that seemed, her mind kept wandering to Edward Brazier. He had obviously kept his word and come for her, only to be thwarted. It was with a sense of horror that she wondered at his reaction. Did he think her complicit? Was it that which had made him angry enough to threaten Henry with a loaded pistol? Surely not. But since she had no recollection herself, any number of disturbing notions were free to play out in her imagination, and none of them brought comfort. Slowly, Betsy raised herself up, and, feet on the floor, pushing upright, she tested her balance, pleased to find it restored. There were no shoes now. They had been removed, so it was with silent, stockinged feet that she crept round the bed, pleased to see her unwanted visitor and his puke had been removed.
creeping up to the chair in which sat her aunt. She looked into a face which, in repose, showed all the lines of her age, as well as her temperament. The jaw hung slightly, which exposed both teeth and a lolling tongue. The lines on either side of her nose, as well as those running down from lower lip to jaw, seemed much more pronounced than when animated, if one excused her expression, too frequently one of disapproval. Turning away, Betsy went to the door, for if there was to be a solution to the predicament Henry had placed her in, it would not be found in her bedchamber. She was put out to find the key missing, and it could only be her Aunt Sarah who had removed it, which led to speculations as regards to motive. Henry's sneering words spoken in his study came back to her. More than any, the fact that the parish register he had alluded to contained Sarah Lovell's signature as a witness. Could that really be true? Could her aunt have colluded in this farrago? Was she being confined as part of that? Reluctantly, Henry had said. What did that mean? Had she been coerced? In frustration, Betsy grabbed the door handle and tugged at it, which created just enough noise to bring Sarah Lovell out of her slumbers. She, too, looking confused as she came into wakefulness. Then she turned towards the door and her niece, her face carrying the same expression of sadness with which she had greeted her earlier.
"How could you?" Betsy said softly. "I tried to dissuade him. You must believe that, Elizabeth."
"Not hard enough," was bitterly delivered. "You could have refused to witness."
Sarah Lovell bit her lower lip. It was obvious she was seeking words to explain, and finding none, or at least not any that would serve as justification.
"Why did you lock the door and remove the key?" "To keep out the servants and Henry, or that slug I found by my bedside earlier. Perhaps it was to keep me in and supine."
"That is cruel, Elizabeth."
Betsy came closer with her riposte, to stand menacingly over her aunt.
"You have the effrontery to use such a word to me."
"I am on your side."
There was a significant pause before she added,
"As much as I can be."
A hand came out.
"Then oblige me with the key."
It was produced, and handed over with an admonishment to be careful. Ignored, as Betsy unlocked the door, adding a parting shot,
"What do I have to fear, Aunt Sarah, now Henry has done his worst?"
She left behind a relative, unsure that her niece had spoken the truth. Chapter 3. If it was seen as eccentric behaviour to swim in the sea of a morning, indeed at any time of the day by most folk of sense, it was even more peculiar that it was done in the company of a trio of armed and tough-looking companions, sporting cutlasses slung over their shoulders. There was, as well, a servant of African extraction bearing an armful of towels who waited right by the shoreline. On this morning, Edward Brazier had a sore head to contend with, the result of imbibing far too much brandy, as well as what he would have found hard to admit to, a damaged heart. The shock of the water close to ice cold was welcomed as a distraction from his troubled thoughts, but not for long. In a vain attempt to keep from reflection, he put extra effort into striking out against the current, one which left a swimmer feeling a total lack of any progress when measured against any object on the shore. If he emerged bodily refreshed, it did not long extend to his reminiscences, including those more distant than the events of the previous night. His attraction to, and pursuit of, Betsy Langridge had been challenging from the very start.
Now, wrapped in towels and on his way back to Quebec House, he reprised their relationship from the very first meeting at the Governor's Ball in Jamaica, given in honour of the King's birthday, one it would have been impolitic to miss. A gaggle of naval inferiors had been present, with whom he could have easily conversed, as well as the soldier types, not least the Governor's aide-de-camp, a young, fresh-faced fellow who'd been delightfully indiscreet on the subject of inter-service rivalries. The bulk of the guests had been civilians, discussing, as always, at least in the case of the menfolk, the concerns that animated them, the price of sugar, and, given they were a profligate lot when in funds, the cost of borrowing to plant a new season's crop. He being a man of healthy appetites and spotting a decidedly attractive female across a crowded room, had prompted questions as to her identity from the governor's wife, the best source possible, which got him a typically sharp response. "You will face a challenge, boarding that particular deck, Captain Brazier." This opinion had been presented in her habitual direct manner, and to that had been added a particularly telling gleam in her eye, which hinted at something more. The leading light of local society, Kitty Clark stood at the centre of everything, including gossip. Not much, it was said, escaped her attention in matters relating to the lives, loves and endemic indebtedness of those who lived on the island, whatever their gender. "I think what you allude to, a trifle premature, Lady Clark," had been his less than candid reply. "I merely wish to lay myself alongside such a charming creature and exchange pleasantries." By holding to the naval metaphor, the Brazier riposte had engendered a soft cackle. Kitty Clark was direct in her opinions, not least in the matter of dalliance and its inevitable aim of conquest, which was much lauded by some and heartily disapproved of by others, to which she was said to give not a fig. Brazier had liked her on first acquaintance for her utter lack of hypocrisy, added to which she came with something of a racy reputation. As a young woman, she'd caused a huge scandal by eloping to Holland with the Earl of Pembroke, despite the fact he was already married and had sired an heir. Even more scandalously, Kitty had gone on to bear Pembroke a son, though it was a boy he acknowledged and supported, as well as one she was openly proud of.
"A pursuit has to begin with a sighting, sir,"
had come with a vigorous wave of her fan.
"And you will have observed you are not alone in your interest. There are vultures circling."
That had been true. In the short time since first spotting this unknown beauty, several men had managed to enter the orbit of her attention. But none, he had also noted, succeeded in staying there for long. "Again," he had insisted, "you're ahead of my purpose."
"Stuff it, Brazier," was what he had got in a brisk reply. "You're a man, and she's a woman, as well as a rare beauty, ripe for the plucking, I'll hazard. What's the point of all your inquiries if it's not to plan an approach, and at the back of your mind, a great deal more?"
It had been time to move matters on from something he had no desire to discuss in detail, even with someone so lacking in tact.
"While I am forced to respect your opinion, Lady Clark, I find, while you've been erroneously dissecting my purpose, you have yet to impart anything of interest about the lady."
"Elizabeth Langridge is her name, though she goes by the diminutive of Betsy. She's a widow, and a wealthy one to boot. If I were you, Brazier, I would set course soon, or you'll find her prize to another."
There being no point in seeking to deflect her low opinion of his intentions, he had listened, as more was conveyed about this Betsy Langridge, how long she had been in the West Indies and the several properties she now owned. Kitty Clark alluded to the sad fate of a husband, ill-equipped to ward off the endemic diseases of the tropics,
What an attractive couple they had been, given they were of the same age and clearly much smitten with each other. The death of her husband badly affected her. She's scarce been seen these 12 months. Such was her grief. This may well be the first occasion on which she has ventured to cross her threshold, and rumour has it she may be returning to England. The lady beside her is an aunt, sent to fetch her, and by all accounts an immovable object to anyone seeking to engage in conversation.
Info.